All right, Jeremiah 39. This event that we're looking at tonight is also recorded in chapter 52. It's also in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. This is the fall of Jerusalem. It says, in the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the tenth month came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Jeremiah, and all, king of Babylon, and all his army against Jerusalem, and they besieged it. And if you look at your notes, I have the date there. That would be January 15th, 588 B.C. Verse 2, and in the 11th year, Zedekiah, in the fourth month, in the ninth day of the month, the city was broken up. In other words, they breached the city walls. And that would be July 18th, 586 B.C. Verse 3, and all the princes of the king of Babylon came in and sat in the middle gate, even Nergal-Sharezer and Sam-Gernabo and Sir-Sekim and Rabsaris and Nergal-Sharezer and Rabmag and all the residue of the princes of the king of Egypt. By the way, Rab means chief. So when you have Rabsaris, that would be the fellow who is chief of the eunuchs. If you have Rabmag, to put an I on there, Rab, the chief of the Magi. And so you have a bunch of Babylonian officials who have come in and taken possession of the city. Now, I'm going to do a very coarse outline of the city of Jerusalem. It's real simple. It goes like this. And there's walls surrounding it, and then you have a wall across here. One of the things about Jerusalem, this is one of the reasons why David chose it as his citadel after he became king. Remember, when he was king of all Judah, he was down in Hebron. And when he was made king of all of Israel, he went to the north of where he was by some distance and went to Jerusalem. Jerusalem at that time was a Jebusite city. It was one of the little pockets of the original inhabitants of the land. And David took the city and made it his capital. And one of the reasons is you've got a ravine that runs on all these sides here. This is the Kidron, and you've got the different valleys here. Now, you've got it drops off to the north, but it doesn't have the deep ravine. It does drop off, however. And so whenever Jerusalem has been taken, it has always been taken by the north because that's the easiest access. As a matter of fact, when they've done digs and so on here, this has been filled up and emptied and filled up and emptied probably 8 or 10 times at least. Because when during times of peace, they would excavate that area and try to create sort of a dry moat. You know, we want to get, you know, scrape this all the way down to the bedrock and create as much of an obstacle as possible. We'd have a little causeway or stairs so people could get in, but we're going to make it as difficult as possible. And then when it's under siege, the people that are laying siege to the city will gather all the junk they possibly can and throw it in there to fill it up. And then whoever takes over next does the same thing. They empty it, and then they fill it back up again. It goes back and forth. All right. So the gate that they are coming into is here on the, roughly, on the north. Now, Jerusalem is not flat. Even once you're inside this, it's not flat. You have, and I'm greatly oversimplifying it, but you have a step up to this level here. And so there was a natural defense across here. And when they came into the city here, they did not have the whole city. The temple and so on was down further. The palaces, they weren't up here at the northern end of the city. They're down further. So here you have the Babylonians. They have breached the city in the north, but the king and the princes and everybody else, the Jews, are still inside. And they're going to have a hard time getting out of here, they can't go back this way. If they're going to get out of here, they're going to be going almost certainly to the east. And that's what they did. So you have these officials. They've come in and they've established themselves in the city gate. That's where the elders of the city would sit. That's where judgment was passed and so on. So they've come in and in essence said, we've taken the city, even though they haven't occupied it all. The defenders are still down here in the southern part of the city. And it can be a long, drawn-out thing, going hand-to-hand from house to house and so on. And there's a lot of bloodshed in that kind of warfare. Very often, depending on the terms and so on, a city might capitulate when this once the city was breached. It was only going to be a matter of time until the city is taken. So that's the setting. It came to pass, verse 4, that when Zedekiah, the king of Judah, saw them, and the word saw does not necessarily mean that he's actually looked over and said, oh, wow, they're there. He understood it to be the case. That when he found out it was so, and all the men of war, now remember, they've been under siege here for 18 months. There was a brief break in the siege where they were able to perhaps get new supplies and so on, but they have been under siege in essence for 18 months. And so you've got basically a ragtag group of guys that are left in the city as far as the military is concerned. And so the men of war and the king fled, and they went forth out of the city by night. Of course, why do you want to do it by night? It's dark, can't be seen. All right, so they want to do it, try to sneak out of there, and went forth out of the city by night by way of the king's garden, which would be in conjunction with the modern pool of Siloam. So that's on the east side as well. By the gate betwixt the two walls, and he went out the way of the plain. Now, between two walls, they're not sure what that means. It could mean a couple of different things. When a city was under siege like this, they would sometimes build a second wall inside the first one, creating a, you know, once they break the first one, oh, there's another wall. And you did, how much space did you have between them? Just enough so you could build the second wall. So you'd have a basic, you know, like a, probably not even as wide as this. You'd have a little causeway, a little, not a causeway, but a little hallway running down between these two. It could be that. In larger cities in ancient times, when they had a city gate, they would, and this was true with Babylon, they know this, perhaps you've seen pictures of this, that when you've got a wall, and here's your gate, here's the interior of the city. Hey, wow, they actually cleaned the board. Here's the gate. Now, I could just put doors across here, but if an enemy is coming from without and he's going to attack these doors, my defenders who are here on the wall have got to shoot it crosswise here like this. If, however, I have it recessed and I put the gates here like that, then in order to get there, you've got to come down this narrow passage here, and they can shoot stuff at you and throw rocks down at you and do all kinds of stuff. That's how Babylon was. If you've ever seen pictures of the Ishtar Gate in Babylon, or seen the pictures of the enameled brick gates with the lions and the dragons and stuff, that was on the sides, the walls going into the city there. Jerusalem may have had something like this on a much smaller scale. Almost certainly had it to some extent. It may have been recessed only as far as it is from here to there, but that'll make a big difference. So anyway, however it was, whether it was inside a double wall or going out something like this, we're not sure. It's conjecture to some extent. Then they fled that way, and they're heading east. They went out by way of the plain. Are there plains in Israel? And I don't mean, you know, are there plains like in flat places in Israel? There's three of them. There's three of them. One is in the north, the Valley of Jezreel, and it runs, let's do our little map here. And we've got Sea of Galilee, Jordan, and the dots Jerusalem. All right. This is overplayed a little bit. You've got a river that runs here, the Kishon, and that is a broad valley. That's a great agricultural place today. Megiddo sits on the edge of that valley, overlooking the valley. That's where I said that we were at the Tell, the hill of Megiddo, and you're looking out across this beautiful checkerboard of fields where they're growing, you know, things like strawberries and different things like this. It's all different colors and stuff. It wasn't just, you know, wheat, barley, rye, you know, soybeans or so. They grew all kinds of unusual things there because it's a subtropical or subtropical climate. And this is where we saw the jets jumping out of the ground. F-16s jumping out of the ground because they have underground runways in Israel. And so you're looking at this field, and all of a sudden there's airplanes jumping out of the ground. And you're going, how, where did they come from? It's very interesting to watch. I've never read about that, but I saw it. And I asked our guide. He says, well, we have some things out there. Okay. You have a plane running along the coast. That's the plane of Sharon. All right. And that's sandy soil along there. Matter of fact, the only golf course in Israel is along here. In modern, not in ancient Israel. They didn't have golf courses in ancient. Yes, in modern excavations, they found the golf course. And then you had, of course, a plane running along the Jordan. And that's the one that they're talking about here. They went down to the east. It's below, well below sea level, many hundreds of feet below sea level, along here. The Sea of Galilee is over 600 feet below sea level. So, they go there, and their idea is they're heading east. Why would they want to head east? Now north, you know, is problematic unless you're just going to try to hide in the hills or something. Why would you head east as opposed to a different direction? There's several reasons why. Okay, there's some allies. Remember that you had this sort of confederation that was trying to resist the advance of Babylon, that were allied with Egypt. And three of those allies were Ammon, Moab, and Edom. Where are they? They're on the east side. They have been enemies to Israel for years and years and years and years and years, but now they have a great big huge mutual enemy. And the Ammonites especially were allies in the rebellion against Babylon, and so they're going to try to make it over to Ammon, which is this area here. They're going to try to get there. All they have to do is cross the Jordan, and they'll be good to go. So, because, you know, no bridges. All right. So if they can get down to Jordan, and it's, 15 miles or so, all downhill, they're taking off as fast as they can go. They know the terrain, and the Babylonians don't necessarily. And so they're taking off, they're heading down to Jordan as fast as they can. Now, of course, the issue is that they have been under siege. They're not in the greatest of shape at this point, but they've got a jump start. And so they take off and they head that way by way of the plain. It says, but the Babylonian army pursued after them and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. He's almost there. He's almost there. Jericho is, ancient Jericho was, just about 2-3 miles from the Jordan, and just a few miles north of the Dead Sea. You don't want to be right down on the Dead Sea because you can't grow anything. The ground is all saturated with salt. So you had to be up far enough upstream so that there was, the salt had leached out of the soil and stuff, you could grow crops. So he gets all the way down here. He could probably see the Jordan, and he's captured before he can get across. Almost there. They overtook him in the plains of Jericho, and when they had taken him, they brought him to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, in Riblah, in the land of Hamath, and there he gave judgment upon him. So here he is way down here. Way up here is a river called the Orontes, and it starts it starts on a ridge right near the Euphrates, but doesn't end up flowing into the Euphrates. It instead flows west and into the Mediterranean. Riblah is where Pharaoh Necho had his headquarters prior to the Battle of Carchemish. It was a great location. It's about 65 miles north of Damascus, Syria today. And so up here, Damascus being roughly there. Okay, remember, this is not a real big place. You know, we're used to, you know, like when I'm going to Michigan and I've got to drive from the Metro Detroit area here up to Houghton Lake, and then down up here to my brother's house, and then back over here. All right. Going from my mom's house here up to where the wedding is going to be would be like driving from here to here. Okay? It's not a big place. So he's captured, and he is taken all the way up here because this is where Nebuchadnezzar is. Nebuchadnezzar has not been the general who's been dealing with all the minutiae. He's telling, okay, Jerusalem, down there, you, and you, go take it. And then you guys over here, you guys, I want you to go deal with these people over here. It's a multi-campaign situation. And Eisenhower wasn't in the field. You know. All right. So, this is what he's doing. And he brings Zedekiah up to Riblah, up here on the river, because that's where his headquarters is. So here you got this guy, and he knows he's doomed. He knows that this is not going to be a good scenario. Now, Jeremiah has told him that he will not die. And that's probably what's running through this guy's head on the march in shackles from Jericho all the way up to Riblah, where judgment will be passed. And here's the judgment, starting at verse 6. And the king of Babylon slew the sons of Zedekiah in Riblah before his eyes. One of the things that was common punishment in ancient times is they would do all kinds of atrocities and horrible things and then blind you. So the last thing you remember seeing was the horrible things. He slew the sons of Zedekiah in Riblah before his eyes. Also the king of Babylon slew all the nobles of Judah. Now, when we say all, this does not mean every single last one. This is the ones who were promoting the rebellion against Babylon, because not everybody in Jerusalem was in favor of what was going on. We know from some indications from archaeology, actually, that there were a number of considerations of capitulation earlier on. But the nobles carried the day. That was where the chief thing, because we got this wishy-washy king. And he's sort of carried along by who's shouting the loudest at him there during those last several years there in Jerusalem. And so he goes through this horrible thing. He has his all these people killed in front of him. And then verse 7, moreover, he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with chains to carry him to Babylon. So that's the judgment on the man himself. Verse 8, and the Chaldeans burned the king's house, the palace. Very often in ancient times, everything was made of stone. And in Jerusalem, you had a mix of cedar, the cedar of Lebanon, which is the biggest tree in that area. It gets to be, you know, great, big, huge, massive tree. They could have, you know, as big a beam as you want to cut out of Douglas fir, just about. And that was the crop. So even when you burn the thing, there's going to be some charred stone and stuff. But the support and so on was primarily, and the crossbeams and the roof and all that was going to be made of wood. So they burn the king's house, the houses of the people, with fire and break down the walls of Jerusalem. When the captives come back after the captivity, was there anything there? It was rubble. In archaeological digs today, there is very little that they find from the kingdom era. They find some, but they find very, very little from the kingdom era. Not only was the city somewhat smaller than it was afterward, but the Babylonians did such a thorough job. And plus, it was under siege. We saw this before in earlier chapters of Jeremiah, that the people inside, the defenders, were largely the ones that destroyed the city, because they took everything they could possibly get, breaking down the houses and everything else to build defenses. So when the Babylonians came in, there was just a few scattered houses that were probably made of stone and stuff that were too difficult to break down. You had the palace, you had the temple, and you had a few scattered important buildings, and that was it. The rest of it had been destroyed by the people within, using that as raw material to build defenses. And so very, very little left from that era. There are sections of wall and so on, but even you go to the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem today, that dates from the period of Herod. There is nothing of the temple or of the palaces from the first temple period. There's nothing in existence that we know of. Nobody's found anything. It's in a museum or something like that. There's nothing. They did a very, very thorough job of destroying the city. So they burned it, and then verse 9, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive to Babylon the remnant of all the people that remained in the city. In other words, those that were the nobodies that were in the city, not the leadership and so on, but the folks that had survived, that remained in the city, and those that fell away, those that deserted, those that heeded Jeremiah's counsel saying, if you get out of here, you're going to survive. People who slipped over the wall in the night and went and surrendered and so on. Those that fell away, and that fell to him with the rest of the people that remained. But Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left the poor of the... So he's going to haul all these people to Babylon. And there aren't that many. There aren't that many that are going to go. I believe it was less than 1,000. And when you consider how many people lived in the land during the time of David, during his census, where you had 1.5 million fighting men, and then you've got just a few thousand people at the end. He left the poor of the people, which had nothing, the destitute. He left them in the land of Judah and gave them vineyards and fields at the same time. So the cultivated land, he just took the destitute people in the land and gave them yes and no, to keep the land under cultivation. Because as forced tributaries to Babylon, they're still going to have to pay taxes. And if you are the overlord of this land that has now been laid waste and you want to gain some revenue from it, you have to leave some people there to cultivate the ground so it'll produce something, because otherwise you can't tax dirt if there's nobody living there to, you know, produce something from it. If revenue is going to be gained, he has to leave some people there to keep the land in cultivation. And so that's what he does. All right, that is what happens. That's the passing of judgment. Now we're going to have some details that are given starting in verse 11. What you've got there is an overview. By the way, let me just give you we have these difficult names there in verse 3. Give you a, let's see. This is trivia. All right, we've got Nergal-Sharezer. Nergal-Sharezer? Nergal-Sharezer was Nebuchadnezzar's son-in-law. He would have been in charge of the military operations there in Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar reigned for something around the neighborhood of 40 years. I have to look it up as far as exactly, but he had a long, long reign. Very effective reign. Ancient Babylon is basically the work of Nebuchadnezzar. His father was a very effective king, but none of his successors were even remotely close to him as far as capability. His son, and in the King James, it's Evil Marduk, sometimes called Amel Marduk. Marduk is a Babylonian deity. Most of the names are conjunction with Babylonian deities. He was Nebuchadnezzar's son. He comes to the throne. He's the one that took Jehoiakim out of prison and had him sitting at the king's table and gave him an allowance and allowed him to have a family and all this other stuff, which gave us, of course, eventually our Lord and so on. All right. Evil Marduk ruled for 2 years. That was it. And he was bumped off. Ancient kings, you know, very hard to get life insurance if you're an ancient king. All right. Evil Marduk is bumped off. And there was a palace intrigue and so on. And he is succeeded by a guy named Nergal-Sharezer. And Nergal-Sharezer is the same guy as Nergal-Sharezer. In other words, Nebuchadnezzar's son-in-law bumped off his brother-in-law so that he could become king. And that wasn't the end of the palace intrigues. There were several other things that went on. Nergal-Sharezer didn't rule for a terribly long time. And you had some other issues come up as well. And so you had a bunch of kings in short succession, which, of course, didn't help with the strength of the Babylonian Empire. Again, the strength of the Babylonian Empire was the strength of their king, Nebuchadnezzar. All right, verse 11. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, gave charge concerning Jeremiah to Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard. Nebuchadnezzar himself, way up here in Riblah, gives some orders regarding Jeremiah specifically. How in the world would Nebuchadnezzar have known about Jeremiah? It's not that hard. How would Nebuchadnezzar have known about Jeremiah and given his underlings specific orders in dealing with Jeremiah? Help me out here. Yeah. How long has Jeremiah been preaching? His ministry was 40 years. And from the get-go, he had said, even before Nebuchadnezzar was king, submit to Babylon. He'd said it from the beginning. So here you got these pagan Babylonians, and they know about this guy. They've heard about him, and they're thinking, here's a guy who's been sort of a closet ally of ours. Not necessarily even closet. He's been an ally of ours inside. And therefore, we want to make sure that the people here know that if you do well by us, we'll do about well by you. And Nebuchadnezzar gives orders to make sure that Jeremiah is taken care of. He says, take him, verse 12, and look well to him, and do him no harm, but do unto him even as he shall say unto thee. Now remember, Jeremiah is an older guy at this time. He's not a young, ambitious guy. He's an older guy at this time. So here's what we want you to do. Whatever Jeremiah says he wants done as far as himself, do it. If he wants to go here, then let him go there. If he wants to go over here, let him do that. And do him well. Do not harm him. Do not frighten him. Just do what's right regarding Jeremiah. So, now, remember, where is Nebuchadnezzar? He's way up here. Jerusalem's down here. It's possible, because some people have said, well, you've got conflict here. Because what it says in one passage is in contradiction to what it said. You can fit it all together without a lot of trouble. And let's do that. It says, verse 13. So you got the orders in verses 11 and 12. What Nebuchadnezzar has said, remember Nebuchadnezzar's way up here in Riblah. He gives orders regarding Jeremiah, who's down here. Before this all, during the siege, we're toward the tail end of it. Here's the order. The orders were given somewhere along the time during the siege. Take care of Jeremiah. So Nebuzaradan, captain of the guards, sent, and Nebushashban, and Rabsaris, and Nergal-Sharezer, and Rabmag, and all the Babylonian princes, even they sent, and so they all know about it. And they took Jeremiah out of the court of the prison. Now, remember, that's where they had put him after he got pulled out of the mud. Remember? And committed him unto Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, that he should carry him home, so he dwelt among the people. Now, we're going to come back to who Gedaliah is. You remember Ahikam and Shaphan? Those are guys who have been mentioned earlier before. Shaphan was a scribe, almost certainly a priest, and he's the guy that when you had the rebuilding of the temple, under Josiah, he's the one that found the scroll and brought it to the king. And they read the scroll before the king, and that's when it started, really, the revival, the reformation under Josiah. Ahikam, his son, so he's a God-fearing man. Shaphan's a God-fearing man. Ahikam, his son, back in Jeremiah chapter 26, was one of the guys who was responsible for saving Jeremiah's life under a certain circumstance. He was a backer of Jeremiah, a defender of Jeremiah. And then you've got Gedaliah, his son, who is, again, a very supportive fella. And so evidently you've got three, father, son, and grandson that are serving the Lord in this line, this lineage. And this is one of the, he's a prince, but he has not been part of the this group that's been supporting the rebellion against Nebuchadnezzar. So he has survived the situation here. So, he's been delivered to Gedaliah. We're going to come back because chapter 40 deals with Gedaliah. Now, the word of the Lord, we got a little digression here. We got to finish up some business from before. Remember that a chapter or so ago, we had Jeremiah's enemies come to the king and said, you've got to do something to Jeremiah because he's undermining morale. In other words, he's going against what we want. He's undermining morale here in the city of Jerusalem. And the king says, do what you want with him. I don't have enough authority to countermand you guys, so you guys just do what you want. And they took Jeremiah, and remember, they don't want to be accused of killing him. They don't want to be accused of executing him. So what they do is they lower him. Instead of throwing him headlong in, they lower him with ropes down into a cistern. an underground water chamber that no longer has water in it, but it says in the King James, mire. It's full of mud. And we mentioned that he was probably up to his waist or even his armpits in mud. And we don't know how long he was there. Couldn't have been too terribly long because you'll die from hypothermia. Even in, if the mud was 80 degrees, you'll still die of hypothermia being in that kind of situation for any length of time. And so you had a fella by the name of Ebed-Melech, who was a eunuch in the palace of the king. And he ran into the king and said, they have done this to Jeremiah. They have put him in there, and he's going to die. And we've got to do something about this. And so the king says, take 30 men. And it wasn't just because it would take that many guys to do it, but this is also to make sure the job would get done so that no one would oppose them. And they went and got ropes, and they tossed down some old rags and told him to put them under his armpits so that he wouldn't get rope burns and stuff. And they pulled him up out of the mud and put him in the court of the prison in this this guardhouse situation, and that's where he was when the city was taken. So Ebed-Melech was the fella that was responsible for delivering Jeremiah. He's the guy that insisted on it. Verse 15. Now the word of the Lord came unto Jeremiah while he was shut up in the court of the prison, saying, go and speak to Ebed-Melech the Ethiopian, and saying, thus saith, now this is during the last siege. This is before the city actually capitulates. But it's right down on the wire. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will bring my words upon this city for evil and not for good, that they may be accomplished in the day before thee. In other words, you will watch what is going to happen, because everything I've been preaching, everything that God has told me is going to happen, is indeed going to happen, and it's going to happen soon, and you're going to see it. You're going to see the city capitulate. You will see the city destroyed. You will see the people being carried off. You will witness all of these things. Verse 17, but I will deliver thee in that day, saith the Lord, and thou shalt not be given into the hand of the men of whom thou art afraid. Who's he afraid of? Could be two different. Remember, the prince is there, probably not real happy with this guy. They wanted Jeremiah dead. And so actually some of the commentators said that the people he was afraid of were the princes. I am much more inclined to think that it's probably the Babylonians. Because we're right here at the end, and I'm under the impression that the princes have probably given up worrying about Ebed-Melech. Verse 18, for I will surely deliver thee, and thou shalt not fall by the sword, but thy life shall be given for a prey unto thee, because thou hast put thy trust in me, saith the Lord. And so God graciously spared his life because of his trust in the Lord, and demonstrated in his intervention on the behalf of Jeremiah. Okay, real quick, any questions on chapter 39? All right, chapter 40. Listen fast. I'm looking to the clock, and we'll try to move a little quicker. And we got some little kids down the hall. We get real, real antsy. All right. The word of the Lord came unto Jeremiah from the Lord after that Nebuchadnezzar, the captain of the guard, had let him go from Ramah. Why in the world was he up in Ramah? Ramah is about, it's probably about 6 miles north of Jerusalem. If you were here with us this morning, that is also where that was Samuel's hometown. So it's just a little ways up here north of Jerusalem. I'm sorry, that's the wrong place. We'll do it here. Just a little bit north of Jerusalem. Why was he there? No, his property was in Anathoth, not too far from there. But he'd been in prison. What happened at Ramah? Well, remember, the city of Jerusalem has been destroyed. Nobody lives there. So what did they do with all the people? They took them to Ramah. Ramah was the processing house, if you will, where they sorted out the prisoners, who was going to go where, who was going to die, who was going to go to Babylon, and who was going to be left behind. And he went there because no one was left at Jerusalem. They may have had, they probably used slave labor to do the destruction, but after the destruction, they hauled them all up to Ramah. And that was going to be the site, the gathering place for those that were going to be deported and or whatever was going to happen to them. So Jeremiah is there, and he had been taken, when he had taken him along, bound in chains. Now that seems to be in contradiction to what we saw in the previous chapter. Jeremiah is taken in chains among all that were carried away captive of Jerusalem and Judah, which had been carried away captive unto Babylon. When Jeremiah was taken from the guardhouse, I don't necessarily think that they said, "Where's Jeremiah? We need to." There he is, over there. You get to go free. The rest of you guys, we're going to put in chains and haul you up to Ramah. I think they gathered everybody and took them up to Ramah. And then they said, "Oh, that's right. We've got to find this Jeremiah guy." Okay, which one of you is Jeremiah? Because that fits everything. You're not having any contradiction there. That fits. That works. And so he's up there. Jewish tradition says that Jeremiah had actually been freed, but he saw everybody else trudging around in chains, and he insisted on going along with them. Possible. Possible. That would work as well. So he's there in Ramah, and it says in verse 2, "And the captain of the guard took Jeremiah and said unto him, The Lord thy God," and this is very interesting, "The Lord thy God hath pronounced this evil upon this place. And now the Lord hath brought it and done according as he hath said. Because ye have sinned against the Lord and have not obeyed his voice, therefore this thing has come upon you." Who's saying this? Nebuzaradan is saying that. The Babylonian guy is saying that. Now, I don't know if he's heard about this. The Babylonians would, they were not hostile to the local religion. The Assyrians were. But the Babylonians were not. They would use it and promote it and so on. If you guys want to do this, that's fine. We'll talk to you on your terms. We believe this, but we'll talk to you on your terms when we're with you. And so he is speaking kindly to Jeremiah, being aware, almost certainly, from what he's heard from higher up, because remember, the captives up there in Babylon have been there for 20 years. That he knows Jeremiah's message, and so he's giving the gist of Jeremiah's message back to him, and saying that it's been in fulfillment of what you have declared. Now, verse 4. "I loose thee this day from the chains which were upon thy hand. If it seem good to thee to come with me to Babylon, come. I will look well unto thee. If it seem thee ill unto thee to come with me to Babylon, forbear. Behold, all the land is before thee. Whether it be seemeth good or convenient to thee to go, thither go." This is following through on what Nebuchadnezzar had said. Let him go wherever he wants. The guy is at total liberty. If he wants to go to Babylon with the rest of the captives, he can do that. If he wants to stay here, if he wants to go to Ammon, if he wants to go to Egypt, if he wants to go wherever he wants, let him go wherever he wants. Look well to him. And I think we don't have any revelations. This is all history that we're looking at. There aren't any revelations given to Jeremiah other than this one to Ebed-Melech as far as what's going on and what the future is. Everything up to this point has been that a city is going to be destroyed and this judgment's going to happen. Well, now it's happened. And Jeremiah he's vindicated. Although he really didn't want this to happen, but that was what God had told him to declare. But now it's all done. Well, now what am I supposed to do? I don't have any instructions as to what I'm supposed to do now. I mean, I've been very faithful up to this point. I've done exactly what God has told me to do. And lo and behold, it happened exactly like God said. And I've been vindicated. And even these foreigners are treating me nicer than my own people did. And they recognize that God has been vindicated. But I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I don't have any instructions as to what I'm supposed to do now. So it says there in verse 5, "And while he was not yet gone back," he didn't make up his mind. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. He just sort of standing there. And Nebuzaradan, comes to him and says, go back. He gives him instructions. He says, you don't know what to do? Okay, let me tell you what I think you ought to do. Go back. Go back also to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, now, whom the king of Babylon has made governor over the cities of Judah. He didn't take a Babylonian and make him governor. He made a good man of the local people there. He made that guy governor, Gedaliah. So go back and dwell with him among the people. Or if you want to go someplace else, that's fine. So the captain of the guard gave him some food and a reward or a present, and we don't know what that is. It's a very generic term, and let him go. Then Jeremiah went unto Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, unto Mizpah, and dwelt among the people that were left in the land. So the people at Ramah who had gathered together, those are going to be deported up to Babylon, but you've got the poor of the land who have been given that, the cultivated fields, the vineyards and the orchards and all this on, and they're going to cultivate the land. And they're at Mizpah. Why are they at Mizpah? Because Jerusalem is no more. We're not sure where Mizpah is. It is, some have said it's 4 miles north of Jerusalem. Some say it's 10 miles north of Jerusalem. They don't know. What do we know? We know it's a little ways north of Jerusalem and not real far from Ramah. So he's not having to walk real far. Couldn't take the train or the bus. He's not real far from Mizpah where, the folks are going to, are gathering. And so the people are starting to gather, starting verse 7. When all the captains of the forces which were in the fields, now these are the parts of the Judean army who were outside of Jerusalem when the Babylonians show up. And there aren't that many of them. You got this Babylonian horde that comes in. We got these, you know, a few hundred here and a couple of dozen over here. You got all these soldiers. And so what do? They might do a little bit of guerrilla warfare and so on, but by and large, they're in hiding. They're waiting for this thing to see what's going to pan out. And so you have the soldiers and so on that were in the field. When even they and their men, when they heard that the king of Babylon had made Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, governor of the land, and had committed unto him men and women and children and the poor of the land, and of them that had not been carried away to Babylon, then they came to Gedaliah at Mizpah. Even Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, and Jehonan, and Jonathan, the sons of Kiriah, and Sariah, and Tehumeth, and the sons of Ephi, and all these other guys. And they came to Gedaliah. Everything, hey, we got a good man here. We got a guy who's capable, and so he is the rallying point there at Mizpah. So the people who are scattered around, they come, and Gedaliah gives them encouragement. He says there in verse 9, Gedaliah the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, swear unto them and to their men, saying, fear not to serve the king or serve the Chaldeans. Dwell in the land, serve the king of Babylon. It shall be well with you. As for me, behold, I dwell at Mizpah to serve the Chaldeans, which will come unto us. But ye, gather ye wine and summer fruit and oil and put them in your vessels and dwell in your cities that ye have taken. Why are they supposed to, you see this once in a while, why are they where to gather summer fruit? When was the city taken? July. A few weeks have passed, it might even be August by this point. When was the harvest for the grain crops? In June. So they missed it. Besides, and plus they've been under siege, so nothing was out in the planted in the field anyway. Now, the Babylonians evidently did not practice what is called total warfare. They didn't devastate the land. So when they went out, the vineyards were still intact. The olive orchards were still intact. The fig orchards and the pomegranates and all this stuff are still intact. So you've got these people, you've got maybe you've got 2,000-3,000 people. What are they going to eat? You've got no grain in storage. What are they going to eat? Well, you know what? We better start drying apricots and making raisins and all this other stuff so that we've got something to eat this next year, this winter, before we put in our grain crops and have bread next year, because we're gonna live off of raisins and apricots and stuff this winter. I like raisins and I like apricots, but if I eat nothing else, I think I get tired of them pretty quick. So when it says the gathering of the summer fruit, that's what they're doing. They're getting the food they can while they can. And put them in your vessels and dwell in your cities that ye have taken. Because there's no people left. But some of these little towns and stuff, some of them were left relatively intact. So, oh yeah, this town over here, Mizpah, and this one over here, they didn't destroy it. They took away all the people, but there's an empty town, so we're going to move into the empty town. And that's what they did. They stayed relatively close to each other, but they moved into the abandoned villages and so on. And again, Mizpah is going to be the capital. It's going to be the rallying point there. That's where the governor, Gedaliah, is going to be. And here's what else happened. Verse 11, news spreads. And so likewise, all the men of the Jews that were in Moab and among the Ammonites and Edom, those who had made it across the Jordan and were with their former allies, heard that the king of Babylon had left a remnant in Judah and that he had set over them Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam. Hey, we got this guy that we know. He's our rallying point. And so they came. Even all the Jews returned out of the places whither they had been driven and came to the land of Judah to Gedaliah and to Mizpah, and they gathered wine and summer fruits in abundance. So they've got enough, and it's like they've survived, and the people have gathered together, and so we've got a population center, and even though we're under Babylon, we've survived, and we're going to make it. But we have a conspiracy in the works. Verse 13, moreover, Jehonan, the son of Korea, and all the captains of the forces that were in the fields, and those the military guys that had come in, came to Gedaliah to Mizpah and said unto him, dost thou certainly know that Balas, the king of the Ammonites, because the kingdom of Ammon survived all this, the Babylonians didn't come here, this is still an independent kingdom, who was part of that alliance, and in fact, it's the most powerful part of the alliance outside of Egypt. You've got Ammon here, you got Moab here, you've got Edom here, and the Egyptians, and they're still allied against Babylon. And this guy has got the most to lose because he's the closest. He's the furthest north. He's the last outpost that has not yielded to Babylon. And so the king of Babylon, King Balas, he says, he sent Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, to slay thee. He sent an assassin in here to kill you, Gedaliah. Because you have become allied with the Babylonians, number one. And also, number two, Ammon has always wanted this piece of ground. And if he could chase the Jews out of here, then maybe he'll be able to add this to his kingdom. Okay, we see a little bit of that in the book of Judges and so on. All right? So he's got several reasons why he might want to bump off Gedaliah. And so Gedaliah has been warned. And they also said there in verse 15, let us go and we'll kill Ishmael. Before he kills you, we're gonna kill him. Now Ishmael is not some, you know, podunk assassin. He's a Judean prince. He is of the lineage of David. Now he escaped and he's been over in Ammon, but he's not a nobody. He's somebody that people would know about. He's a prince of the kingdom, and he might have a vested interest in getting rid of Gedaliah, because after all, Gedaliah is not of the line of David, and I am. So there's a number of reasons why Gedaliah would have enemies, even though Gedaliah is a popular guy and people are rallying to him, and he's viewed as the temporal savior of the situation. And so he's been warned, and they're saying, let's kill Ishmael. So he won't kill you, because if that happens, all the Jews who were gathered unto thee shall be scattered, and the remnant of Judah will perish. You're the rallying point, and if you are killed, what's going to happen to all these people? But in verse 16, Gedaliah the son of Ahikam said unto Jehonan, the son of Korea, thou shalt not do this thing, for thou speakest falsely of Ishmael. Ishmael wouldn't do such a thing. And if you're really dying to find out what's going to happen, go ahead and read ahead. If not, we'll be covering this again in 2 weeks. All right. Any other questions that might come up on what we've looked at tonight? It doesn't get neater and prettier. I'll let you know that. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. And Father, it seems like people never learn. They heard the preaching of Jeremiah, and it was all vindicated. And now they're starting over again, and they're going to have more problems. And Jeremiah is going to be receiving revelations from you, and he's going to tell the people, and they're still not going to pay attention to him. Father, people don't change. the wicked will continue in their wickedness and their rebellion against you, regardless of what they say with their lips. Father, may we be faithful. May we, as your children, be in submission to what you have revealed to us in your word. And Father, may we be faithful. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.